Welcome to the podcast of Media Matters with Bob McChesney, a weekly show on media from WILL Radio. Visit us at will.uiuc.edu.
Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you in WILL AM 580 in beautiful Urbana, Illinois, from Campbell Hall, our gracious studios on the campus of the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. Today, we've got one of our favorite guests on Media Matters, someone we've had on many times who speaks widely on a number of subjects, University of Texas journalism professor and journalist, author, and writer, Bob Jensen. So please stay tuned today for Media Matters. But first, let's go to Media Minutes.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news relating to the intersection of media and democracy. I'm John Anderson.
And I'm Kimberly Cronick.
The Freedom of Information Act turned 40 on July 4th, and just in time, the federal government launches a project to examine ways to thwart it. Scholars at St. Mary's University School of Law in San Antonio, Texas, are being paid $1 million to analyze various federal and state secrecy laws with the goal of devising a unified statute that makes it easier for government to restrict access to information, some of which may now be publicly available. This research project is being overseen by the U.S. Air Force, and in a note of historical irony, one of the original congressional co-sponsors of the Freedom of Information Act was none other than the current Secretary of Defense, Donald Rumsfeld, a former representative from Illinois. Meanwhile, it's getting harder to successfully use the Freedom of Information Act. A report from the Coalition of Journalists for an Open Government says nearly one out of every three FOIA requests filed with federal agencies last year is stuck in some sort of bureaucratic quicksand. You've got a better than even chance of prying loose government information via the Freedom of Information Act, but if you challenge a denial in court, the government's got better than even odds of winning that case.
The Big Brother building process continues apace in America. Since 2004, some 52 federal government agencies have gotten involved in the practice of purchasing personal information on American citizens from private data mining companies. These companies collect information on people, largely through consumer purchases and subscriptions, and aggregate this information into a single database, which can then be analyzed for patterns. There's no definitive record of just how much money is being spent on such activity, nor is it clear how data mining is actually being used by the government. Meanwhile, the Justice Department is quietly meeting with executives from major phone, cable, and internet content companies and requesting that they save information on those who use their services for up to 2 years, all in the name of fighting terrorism and child pornography. What most interests federal officials are web searches and email records.
Does the most powerful man in the United States Senate on issues involving telecommunication and media even know what the internet is? In a recent hearing on major legislation rewriting whole sections of federal telecom law, Alaska Senator Ted Stevens, the Republican chairman of the Senate's Commerce Committee, the main gatekeeper for any internet-related legislation, argued passionately both for and against the principle of network neutrality, all in the same speech. In a screed that clocked in over 10 minutes, Stevens, who earlier this year expressed a belief that analog and digital people exist, described the internet as a, quote, messaging service that is, quote, essential to the operation of families. He was probably talking about email, but in the mind of Senator Stevens, one email may very well contain the informational universe.
I just the other day got internet was sent by my staff at 10 o'clock in the morning on Friday. I got it yesterday. Why? Because it got tangled up with all of these things that are going on the internet commercially.
While Stevens argued vehemently against carving the internet up into tiers of service where the potential for democratic communication is done away with in exchange for a system where your ability to speak is determined by how much you're willing to pay for the privilege, the bill he's sponsoring contains no provisions prohibiting such data discrimination. Near the end of his tirade, Stevens made analogy reality, taking folks like AT&T's CEO Ed Whitaker literally when they talk about their pipes. The senator actually seems to believe that the internet's just another form of plumbing.
The internet is not something that you just dump something on. It's not a big truck. It's a series of tubes. And if you don't understand, those tubes can be filled. And if they're filled, when you put your message in, it gets in line. It's going to be delayed by anyone that puts into that tube enormous amounts of material. Enormous amounts of material.
Not only is the internet not a series of tubes, online information is not crammed into a single package and shoved off to its destination like a parcel going through the mail. Information is broken up into packets, which can take many different routes to the same end point. And the internet is far from being clogged with information. Many of the most advanced fiber optic networks operate at just a fraction of their capacity to handle data. Stevens has raked in more than $70,000 in direct campaign donations from the major phone and cable companies in the 2006 election cycle. That's impressive, especially when you consider that he's not up for re-election until 2008. You've been listening to Media Minutes, a joint production of the Illinois Initiative for Media Policy Research at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign and Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization dedicated to media democracy. For more information, visit our website at freepress.net.
Greetings. Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you from Campbell Hall on the campus of the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. Home to WILL AM 580, where I speak to you today. We've got a wonderful guest today, one of our favorite guests here on Media Matters, I think now setting the record for most appearances by someone not named John Nichols. It is Bob Jensen, the University of Texas journalism professor, who's written numerous books and countless articles on politics and on journalism and on the media. It's a pleasure to welcome him today to our phone lines. Bob?
With you, Bob.
Well, you know, there's a lot of ground to cover, a lot of stuff I want to talk with you about, your analysis of the world and the media, and also some of your own experiences in the last few months that have gained some attention nationally. First, though, in our last couple shows, I think for self-evident reasons, have concentrated a lot on the war in Iraq, the U.S. occupation of Iraq and the Bush presidency. And I'd like to sort of get your take on it. For starters, I mean, what is your sense, and I know you've written about empire, what is your sense of how the Iraq war will measure up historically when the dust finally settles there, if it does finally settle?
Well, I think it will be, akin to the Vietnam War, to the U.S. excursion into Southeast Asia, which fundamentally changed the direction of American politics, for at least for a few years. It, in fact, may be an even greater debacle than the Vietnam War. It may unleash forces that have even a greater effect on the trajectory of the world. I mean, it's certainly plausible to imagine that. We know in the short term it's stalling the Bush presidency, and we can hope perhaps stalling the quest for dominance that the Bush administration intensified. And I use that word intensified deliberately because while I think the Bush administration, the ideological fanaticism that drives the Bush administration is extremely dangerous, it's not a break from U.S. history. It's an intensification of trends that we see, especially in post-World War II U.S. history, that drive to empire, that drive to especially deepen and extend American dominance in the Middle East for the obvious reasons of its energy resources. So if that quest for empire is slowed in a sort of way, that's a good effect of the Iraq War. I say that knowing that it's hard to say anything good about a war that has destroyed so many lives and really thrown a region into such chaos, but that at least we can see as positive.
You know, one of the themes of this show, and I think of virtually all media analysis now, or much of it in the last 3 years, has been how prior to the invasion of Iraq in 2003, the press coverage in the United States was woefully inadequate and did a very poor job of questioning, interrogating the claims of the Bush administration as it took the United States to this war. And there have actually been mea culpas written in various news media for the war coverage leading up to the war in the New York Times, the Washington Post, and other major news media. Do you think the lessons have been learned when you pick up the New York Times today or watch CNN or MSNBC or the Nightly News? Do you think, like, okay, they've learned the lessons, now we can trust these guys, they're going to get it right from here on out?
Well, first of all, I hate to pick nits, but I have to take issue with the phrase that U.S. news coverage in the run-up to the Iraq War was woefully inadequate. It would have had to have worked much harder to be woefully inadequate. It was far worse than that. I think it was probably the most profound failure of journalism in the United States, at least in my lifetime. There's virtually nothing good that can be said about the corporate commercial news media's coverage in the run-up to the Iraq War. As you point out, there has been a shift, but I think it's mainly illusory, quite frankly. Let's look at those apologies or editor's notes or stories that were written by the major newspapers, specifically the Times and the Post. Well, in a sense, those apologies explained the core of the problem, because while they acknowledged that they didn't do enough critical and skeptical reporting in the run-up to the war, they for the most part accepted the Bush administration line that the war was a result of intelligence failures. So in looking at their own behavior and judging it as inadequate, the media actually further endorsed the Bush administration program of deception, which is to say, you know, this was about some mistakes we made. Well, this is where the U.S. news media, even though it's reporting a little more honestly about the conduct of the war, which I think is quite frankly simply because it would be impossible to ignore a debacle of this scope, but I think what they're still doing is refusing to acknowledge the reasons that the United States went to war. They're still, in a sense, peddling the Bush administration line, which was also endorsed by much of the Democratic Congress, of course, that this was somehow a good-faith attempt to protect the United States from weapons of mass destruction and terrorism, and we just got it wrong because of intelligence failures. Well, intelligence failures were used to manipulate public opinion, but the goal of the war had nothing to do with weapons or terrorism. It had to do, I think, as we can see from looking at 60 years of U.S. history in the Middle East, it had to do with that project of extending and deepening American dominance in the region. As long as the U.S. news media cannot come to terms with that fundamental question, which, let's face it, around the world is almost taken as a given. I mean, you can travel anywhere in the world and ask people, why did the United States go to war in Iraq? And people will shrug and say, well, oil. Now, it's complex the way in which the United States wants to control the Middle East and control that resource. But it's a no-brainer around the world. It's only in the United States that we still have to fuss about this. And that's where the most profound media failure is to understand its role in explaining the whole structure of U.S. foreign policy.
Our guest today on Media Matters is Bob Jensen, University of Texas journalism professor, a noted author, frequent guest in this program, and a working journalist himself, well known for his coverage of a broad range of political issues, including pornography, women's rights, racism, foreign policy, the U.S. role, and especially for his trenchant critique of news media. This is a pre-recorded show. We taped it shortly before going on air, so please don't call in today. Sit back, relax, and let the professional yakkers professionally yak. Bob Jensen, on the issue of President Bush, we had Eric Bollard on the show a couple weeks ago talking about his new book, Lapdogs, about the press coverage of the Bush administration. As you can imagine, it was quite critical from the title, and you're probably familiar with the book. What is your sense of how Bush is treated by the press? I mean, and the reason I ask this is that, you know, Bush is constantly complaining about the press coverage in his administration. I mean, what are we supposed to believe?
Well, you know, this goes to the heart of the critique of the liberal media. The right wing for decades has been trying to condition the American public to accept as a given the fact that the media is liberal. And this is the framework in which President Bush can say, well, the media is tough on me. Well, I think, you know, we can see in at least the post 9/11 period, Bush essentially got a free ride. Now, to some degree, that was a function of the time. But it also does play into this fear that mainstream corporate reporters have now of being labeled liberal if they're too critical. Now, it's interesting to just look at the treatment of Bush versus Clinton. I'm no fan of Bill Clinton's presidency, but the news media were like pit bulls on Clinton. You know, Whitewater, sexual scandals, all of those things, some of which were important stories, some of which were basically made up out of whole cloth by the right-wing propaganda machine. But whatever the case, the U.S. news media, mainstream corporate news media, had no problem digging their teeth into Bill Clinton. Now, that kind of coverage of the Bush administration simply hasn't happened. And I think it's a function of that decades-long propaganda campaign to convince the American public that the news media are dangerously left-wing. It's a parallel to the attack on the universities, that the American universities are controlled by a bunch of crazed, you know, radicals, you know, secret communist cells everywhere waiting to take over America and destroy the minds of our children. You're familiar, of course, with that, and those are very much of a kind. The fact is, of course, the U.S. news media and the universities are centrist to right-leaning institutions almost by nature. But there are always, you know, little bits of truth to the critique which allows the right to pursue this. So Bush is gotten at some points in his presidency basically a free ride, and the critique that is leveled at him today is still, I think, extremely lukewarm.
We're talking to Bob Jensen on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Again, this show is taped shortly before going on air, so please don't call in today. One of the big stories, Bob Jensen, that emerged, I think, roughly 4 or 5 weeks ago, was a cover story in Rolling Stone magazine written by Robert F. Kennedy Jr., a long piece, a detailed piece, arguing that the 2004 presidential election was stolen and that the real winner was John Kerry, and that this was actually a major crime. And since then, the story has not really exploded. It hasn't quite taken off. I don't know if you've read the Kennedy story or you followed this at all. I'd be interested in your take on it. And I'd also like your analysis of the press coverage of Kennedy's report.
Yeah, I did read the Kennedy piece in Rolling Stone. I've been, like many people, I've been following the voter fraud and some of the more general issues around the integrity of the voting system, electronic voting, all those sorts of issues. I am yet not convinced that there was a true conspiracy to steal the 2004 election. Was there, you know, dirty dealing? Yes, but that's not unique to 2004. It's not unique to the Republicans. The first thing I always like to remind folks is that there's been voter fraud as long as there's been elections, and that's in the United States, too. You know, we do have some reason to think there was one presidential election that literally was stolen, and that was the 1960 election in which John Kennedy beat Richard Nixon. And the quip is that the votes that would have elected Richard Nixon, the Republican candidate, ended up at the bottom of the Chicago River when Mayor Daley's machine fixed that election. So, first of all, we should not take this as some sort of unique moment in U.S. history. I think more important than that particular question of was there an actual conspiracy is to point out that in the 2000 and the 2004 election, there were more kind of almost routine forms of harassment, especially racialized harassment. I have a friend, a civil rights attorney, who was a voter monitor in Florida in 2004, and she said she was shocked. She's an African-American woman. She was shocked at the kind of overt racialized harassment of voters by Republican operatives at the polls. Those are, you know, more entrenched, more difficult questions, I think, to deal with than whether or not in Ohio there was some sort of nefarious conspiracy. I'm not discounting the possibility of that. I certainly think people are capable of such misdealings. But the press coverage, whatever we want to say about the event, the press coverage has been extremely limited. I think it's one of those issues that the mainstream press is just terrified to go too close to. Number one, because it isn't well established what the facts are. And even bringing up the subject will produce the predictable right-wing Republican attack that this is all part of a plan to make George Bush and the Republican Party look bad. So with that in place, it's very easy, I think, for mainstream journalists to just take a pass on this one. They should, if they were taking their mandate seriously, should be part of, in fact, should be leading the investigation, since other branches of the government are not doing it.
I mean, unless someone does bring the facts out, it just feeds the frenzy of people right to speculate and rumors.
Right, and you know, I think it indicates that people fundamentally don't trust the political process, and that's another place we can go to gain some insight, is why should they trust the political process? We see scandals around lobbying. We see scandals around political campaign contributions. We recognize that, in fact, what we call campaign contributions is just kind of a polite word for overt bribery these days. You know, half the people don't vote in this country, and we wonder why. Well, it seems to me quite obvious why is people feel like the system is just absolutely bankrupt. Those are the places that this kind of question about the voting in 2004 could lead us if the mainstream media were willing to take on that level of analysis of the fundamental breakdown of this political system.
Yeah, another story to wrap up this discussion of Bush for this part of the show, Bob Jensen. Another story that seems to be getting little attention in the news media, yet gets a lot of attention from callers to this show, from the guests on this show, and according to polling data, has a wide amount of support in the American population, is the question of whether President Bush should be impeached. What's your take on the Bush impeachment issue, and what's your sense of the press coverage of the issue?
Well, it's certainly a legitimate topic. And as you know, many left critics have pointed out, you could have asked the same question about impeaching every post-World War II U.S. president. You know, Noam Chomsky has a famous quip that if we applied international law in any reasonable way, every president since World War II would have been hung for war crimes. So, you know, talk about high crimes and misdemeanors. They go across administrations. And certainly the Bush administration, when we look simply at the run-up to the war to Iraq, has things to account for. And when we think of our last experience of impeachment around crimes far less dramatic, to say the least, it seems like an obvious question. On the heels of the Clinton impeachment scandal, why are we not talking about this in Bush? Well, we're not talking about it for two reasons. One is the Democrats are terrified of bringing up the issue. They don't control either House of Congress, so they know they have no power to move forward. And they're not about to risk any political capital on this, even though, as you point out, the public is hungry for it. Here again, we see the disconnect between the public and the professional politicians. We're told that politicians do nothing but watch the polls day in and day out, and that's partly they lack leadership qualities. Well, the fact is, on this one, if the politicians were watching the polls, they would be, in fact, pushing for impeachment hearings, and we don't see that. That tells you about how real power works and where real power lies, which is, of course, not with the people in that sense, but with institutions that control the wealth of this country. The media, again, is simply not willing to move out on its own to raise the issue. I heard a Washington Post reporter say once, you know, if the opposition party, whatever it is, the Republicans against the Democrats or vice versa, he says if the opposition party won't pursue a political point, the news media is too timid to bring it up on their own. They're perfectly happy to give some sort of amplification to a quote-unquote legitimate political party's agenda, but they will not create that agenda on their own. And I think that's an abdication of one of the basic responsibilities of contemporary journalism in a society like this. I think the funny thing about news media today is if we want to critique them, we don't even have to critique them on some left-wing platform. We can critique them on their own stated mission. We can go to the Society of Professional Journalists Code of Ethics and go down the line and see that on all of the major points, by their own standards, the U.S. news media is failing to fulfill its role in a democratic society.
Our guest today on Media Matters is Bob Jensen, professor of journalism at the University of Texas at Austin, author of many books. And what's your website, Bob, if people want to follow your writings more closely?
The easiest way to get me is just plug my name into Google. The URL is a little cumbersome, but...
This is Robert Jensen.
Robert Jensen, and if you spell my last name right...
J-E-N-S-E-N.
Even my students misspell it, so I'm used to it, but it'll pull up that page right away.
Okay, wonderful. And, you know, Bob, you came on the radar for a lot of people, I think, in the aftermath of the 9/11 attacks in 2001 for some controversy about some statements you made that caught the attention of some politicians in the state of Texas and nationwide. Some of our listeners, in fact, most of them, I suspect, are not familiar with the story or might not recall it. I want you to talk a little bit about that because I want to talk about your recent distinction of being named one of the 101 most dangerous professors in the United States by David Horowitz. But first, let's give this background. If you talk about your experiences after 9/11.
Sure. Prior to 9/11, I was mostly doing local organizing here in Austin and writing for local papers and occasionally rubbing up against the administration of UT on things like labor issues and affirmative action. But it was 9/11 that really sort of put me in the soup. I did write and in fact wrote a very critical commentary about where I thought the Bush administration was going to take us after 9/11, which was, of course, to war, which was fairly obvious at that point. It ran in the Houston paper, which is the largest statewide paper, and led to a real flood of criticism of me, denunciations that eventually led the president of the University of Texas, in what people here tell me is an unprecedented move, to publicly condemn me and to reassure the people of the state of Texas that no one really took me seriously on campus. I always thought that raised an interesting question. If I was so absolutely so utterly stupid that no one should pay attention to me, why did they give me tenure? That would be an interesting question to ask, but I guess that never came up. And that led to the essentially, you know, you're familiar with this, of course, because your name is in this kind of right-wing machine as well, which dredges up examples of scandalous professors who are trying to destroy America. And that led eventually to David Horowitz's book, The 101 Most Dangerous Professors. So it was that set of events and how I reacted to them that kind of put me into the public eye in quite a new way.
Now, you were named to this Horowitz list, as you noted, as was I. This came out a few months ago in the winter of 2006,
yeah,
with the intent, I think, of sort of stirring a national swarm of outrage at these particular professors, including yourself. Are you concerned about this agenda? How effective do you think it is? Where is this going to go down the road?
Well, I don't have any personal concerns, of course, partly because I'm a tenured professor and I have enormous protection and privilege. But even beyond that, it's really not a question of the individual. It's a question of how does this fit into a right-wing campaign? And we can link this up to the attack on the media as well. As I said earlier, both the news media, the corporate news media, and the universities are pretty centrist to right-leaning institutions. They're run both in increasingly corporate style and in a way that allies them with the corporate world more directly. This is a huge change in the last two or three decades, the degree to which these institutions have been subordinated to power. Why would the right wing, you might ask the question, given that they control Congress, they control the presidency, they control much of the federal court system, they almost by definition control the corporate world, they are the corporate world, why in the world would they worry that there's a couple of little outposts, you know, the news media and the universities, which while not radical, at least give some space to people who still have kind of traditional Enlightenment ideals about pursuing the truth? Well, I think it's partly the logic of domination. When you control almost everything, I think there's an instinct to want to control it all. And I think David Horowitz and people like him are simply the kind of attack dogs of that right-wing power structure to say, we might as well close off all of the space for critical inquiry in this culture. Let's just get rid of all, because what good is it? Now, it's hard to do because both the university and the news media are populated by professionals, professional teachers, professional journalists, who do retain ideals, no matter how much we may be corrupted by the system we work in. Both of those professions have ideals that are basically about the commitment to the free pursuit of truth. And they don't give those ideals up quietly, and that's why it has to be busted. And so this book, The Professors, I mean, I call it a book. It's pages between covers. But it's not a book in any meaningful sense that it has any coherent argument. It's just a collection of half-truths and innuendo and distortions. I look at the chapter, the two or three pages about me, and I kind of recognize that they're talking about me, but it bears no relationship to the way I actually live and teach. But it doesn't have to, because it's purely propaganda in that sense.
Well, where do you think this is going to go? I mean, do you think this is a one shot and it's going to fade away, or is this going to be just the opening shot in a long-term campaign?
No, I think it's sort of the middle of the campaign. Remember that Horowitz has been on this soapbox for quite a long time. There's a group called Students for Academic Freedom, which is the Horowitz clan's attempt to organize right-wing students to pursue this on individual campuses. I think we're seeing kind of the mid-phase of this campaign. In the end, I believe what they really want to do is destroy the system of tenure. Now, there's a lot of problems with the tenure system, that system that gives professors guarantees of lifetime employment, where they can only be fired for cause and can't be fired for their political or intellectual positions. The tenure system, as you well know, Bob, you've seen the ugly side of it as well, but it is the one place where there's some meaningful protection for political dissidents, for people with counter ideas in intellectual spaces. And I think they just want to get rid of it. They want to get rid of it because it's of no value to power, and it's no value to the people who want to use the universities more directly to produce profit for the private sector. And we're already seeing tenure being scrutinized. Some universities are I think, fairly close to abolishing tenure, going to 3-year or 5-year contracts, many systems out there. But I think that the long-term goal is to destroy the notion of intellectual life in the academic setting as having a kind of autonomy. They want to get rid of that because what good is autonomy? It doesn't produce profit.
Our guest today in Media Matters is Robert Jensen, University of Texas, journalism professor, author of numerous books. Just Google the name Robert Jensen, J-E-N-S-E-N, and you can go to websites with his writings and materials about Bob Jensen. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. We're coming to you on WILL AM 580. This show was pre-recorded shortly before going on air, so please sit back, relax, and let us do the talking today and enjoy this lovely summer afternoon. I hope it's lovely. It is today, our day of recording. Bob Jensen, you also came in the news in the last few months for a very interesting story that I'm intrigued by and I want to talk to you about. You joined a Presbyterian church in your hometown of Austin, Texas, or where you live in Austin, Texas. Yet at the same time that you joined it, you admitted or stated that you don't believe in God. And this has created, I guess, I wouldn't even say a minor furor, based on the clips I've been reading, a major furor in the world of Presbyterianism and Christianity. Can you give some background on this story?
Well, Brother Robert, I'm glad you're asking the question. This is a... I have had a relationship with a very left-leaning, very progressive, and very, you know, just wonderful Presbyterian church in Austin, St. Andrew's Presbyterian. And I've been doing political programs there. We've been doing a film series of political documentaries. It's a place that has fought many battles for women's right to choose, for gay rights. The pastor there, Jim Rigby, has already been up in front of the judicial system of the Presbyterian Church once. He almost got kicked out. Well, because I found them so progressive and thoughtful, Jim Rigby is probably one of the brightest theologians I've met recently, I thought, well, let's see about joining, moving from simply being an ally to being a member. And I explained to them that, you know, I didn't have traditional theological beliefs. I don't believe in God in the conventional way people usually mean that.
Were you raised a good Lutheran with a name?
I was actually raised in the Presbyterian Church, and I was baptized and confirmed in the Presbyterian Church in Fargo, North Dakota. So there was a sort of historical resonance there. But it was mainly this congregation and the minister there that led me to want to join in with them in a formal way. And one of the things that church has been home to is people who don't have conventional theological beliefs. And actually, you know, if you went around, especially to the more liberal-leaning, but even the centrist Protestant churches, at least, I can speak for, I think, in the United States, and ask people, how many of you believe, literally, that Christ was resurrected and that that's a historical fact? Well, a lot of people would probably say no. They would say, I take it as symbolic of the capacity to transcend. You know, in other words, Scripture and the whole tradition is interpreted in various ways, everything from literal interpretations of the fundamentalists to very, I think, progressive sort of symbolic interpretations by many people who would lean left.
No, certainly true of the church I was raised in.
Yeah. Now, I think what we're trying to raise here through this controversy is, what does it mean to be a Christian? Now, a lot of people say, well, as long as you can stand up and say, Jesus Christ is my Lord and Savior, you're a Christian. In other words, it's a question of faith or belief. We're raising the question, is it something more than that? Is it also a question of how one acts in the world? Is it simply not the ability to repeat a creed? The pastor there, Jim Rigby, said that they found a parrot doll that has a little chip in it, and it will repeat anything you say. And he quips that, you know, that mechanical parrot can now join the Presbyterian Church because it can say, Jesus Christ is my Lord and Savior. I can't say that because those words don't mean much to me. Certainly the traditional meaning of them doesn't resonate for me. So I did formally join the church. I did write about it because as a professor and as a public intellectual, if you know, a term I'm never terribly comfortable with, but it does seem to be our role, it seemed to me this was a way to open up a discussion about the relationship of politics to religion, about deep theological questions that I think many people struggle with. And the conservative wing of this particular regional body of the Presbyterian Church contains many conservative folks who took great offense at what I wrote, and they brought the church, not just me, but the entire church up on charges, St. Andrew's Presbyterian, claiming that my membership was, my favorite phrase, irregular. And therefore, at a meeting recently of that regional body, they voted to basically expel me from the church. My membership was declared null and void. Now, that's all on hold pending an appeal. But what we would like to do at St. Andrew's is use this as a platform to say, what does it mean to be a Christian? What kinds of beliefs must one have? You know, how must one interpret the text? Is there any sort of play in this system where people can come to their own understandings? Because, let's face it, at least the Protestant churches are not in a growth cycle. And if people feel that it's not friendly to that kind of exploration, certainly it's not going to increase membership. So there's very practical reasons the church should be, you know, taking this seriously.
And clearly you think this is an important debate. I mean, you've taken time out of your life to join a church and participate in it. I mean, why are you doing this instead of organizing demonstrations or public outreach, doing educational work on some of the other issues you work on? Why is this taking Bob Jensen's attention?
Well, I do still continue to work. We have an active left political group in town called the Third Coast Activist Resource Center, and we do public education around questions of war, peace, and global justice, and that work continues. I haven't let up on any of that. I frankly don't spend a lot of time organizing anti-war demonstrations anymore because I think that strategically that is not a winning solution at the moment. For better or worse, whether I'm a religious person in traditional terms or not, this is a very religious culture. Something like three-quarters of the American public identifies as Christian. A third of this country identifies as basically fundamentalist. It's a culture that, compared to all the other industrial democracies, is extremely religious. Now, whatever one thinks of that, church is a place where people go to deal with the fundamental questions of what does it mean to be a person and what are my obligations to other people in this world. And those are fundamentally, of course, not only spiritual questions but political questions. So my attraction to the church in general, to religious institutions and specifically to this one, is that they are sites where discussion still goes forward. And, you know, I think you would probably agree, Bob, that one of the real problems in this country is not just the move to the right or the problem of the war. It's that political dialogue, the ability of ordinary people to see that politics means a constant engagement with each other, is, in fact, a severe problem. This is a very depoliticized culture. It's a very fragmented and isolated culture. And for better or worse, church is still one place where people come to do that. And when other spaces like that atrophy in the culture, I guess I'm just promiscuous. I'm willing to go anywhere where people want to talk about issues that matter.
Do you think the evangelical tradition of Protestantism, which is oftentimes associated with political right-wing politics or fundamentalist tradition, they're somewhat different, I know, but do you think that those traditions are incompatible with the sort of political humanistic vision you have of the world, or do you think that therefore you need to work with the mainline traditions, or what's your sense?
No, I think, you know, evangelical, as you point out today, is essentially synonymous with fundamentalism, with a kind of literal interpretation of the Bible, which is almost always politically very conservative, not because it has to be, but because that's the convergence of forces. I think if the evangelical tradition, taken in its sort of most basic sense, is about trying to speak to others about truth you have, well, then I think, you know, Marxists are evangelical. In that sense, anybody who takes seriously the work of trying to change the world for the better can be seen as kind of evangelical. Now, I'm not a historian of religion. I don't pretend to be a theologian. The question of whether certain traditions can be used in certain ways is a complex one. But I certainly know that the spirit that animates many of the people I have worked with politically, this includes Catholic pacifists that I met during the 1990s in the Iraq sanctions campaign. You know, I've worked with a Jesuit priest. I've worked with Protestant ministers. I've worked with people from those congregations. And what we come to always understand is that there's a certain underlying humanism that animates all of our work, a concern for taking the principles we all claim to hold, principles about equality and the inherent dignity of all humans, and principles which are pretty consistent across traditions. They're there in Islam, they're there in Christianity, they're there in secular Western philosophy, and trying to connect up what we have in common. I think that's the potential, and it's an ecumenical spirit in that sense, not only ecumenical within, you know, Christian denominations, or not only ecumenical within religions, but in a sense ecumenical in the broadest possible sense. And to me, at this moment in history, it seems like that's a path worth exploring. Now, 5 years from now, it may turn out I was wrong, but again, I'm willing to try anything that looks intriguing these days.
Now, I saw in one of the news articles about your expulsion from the Presbyterian Church, or you've been reduced to the pre-baptism stage. They've taken away your baptism, apparently.
No, let's be technically accurate here. You know, we're journalists. We want to make sure we the actual recommend or the vote that was taken on me a couple of weeks ago was to move me off the active member role,
mm-hmm.
so that I would not have a role in voting and church elections and that sort of thing.
But I did
move me to what they call the baptized role.
Okay,
is for children who've been baptized but have not yet been confirmed. So they want to kick me back to kind of pre-confirmation now. I haven't pulled out the fact that I'm already technically a member because I was confirmed in another Presbyterian church. That seemed to me to be legalistic, and we want to pursue the issue for the theological implications, not just to win. So,
well, I noticed what they said. Someone said in the news article is that if you wanted to go to church, you should just become a Unitarian.
Well, one of the funniest responses I got to the piece I wrote was from Unitarians, and many of your listeners, I'm sure, are familiar. The Unitarian Universalist tradition is non-theistic. It's kind of a home for people who want to pursue a spiritual path without any particular dogma. And I will just say, I've never found myself drawn to the Unitarian concept. It just doesn't resonate for me for whatever reason. But I got a lot of mail from Unitarians saying, "You don't realize you're one of us. And why don't you come join us?" It was almost like, you should be on our team. So the reaction to it was very interesting. That was, of course, only a small segment. The rest of the mail I got teaches us a lot, I think. I got mail from committed Christians who felt I was mocking them and was trying to take away some fundamental tenet of the faith. I got email from Christians saying, "I agree, it's about struggle with meaning, it's about the search, not about dogma." And then, interestingly, I got mail from left activists, people who would be considered, my tribe politically, who some of whom, said, "Well, more power to you if you can figure out how to make this work." But many who said, you're somehow abandoning the rational tradition, you're somehow sort of going over to the other side. They couldn't imagine that an attempt to search for meaning through theological structures could be politically engaged. And I thought that was interesting, too. I think there's a lot of people on the left who just are so down on religion. And I must say, as someone who suffered through a very unpleasant religious upbringing myself, I certainly had my periods where I just didn't want to go anywhere near a church. I'd had enough of it. But at this point in my life, I'm about to turn 48, and I'm getting old, and it seems to me this is a place to give another spin around with.
Our guest today is Bob Jensen. This is Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. We taped this show shortly before going on air, so please sit back, relax, and enjoy the show. Bob, speaking of another sort of sacred area in American life, patriotism, we just had the 4th of July weekend, or holiday, I should say, and this is always a moment of celebration of the American experience, and you have been one of the leading public critics of U.S. militarism and empire, not just in the Iraq War, but going back decades, if generations, quite critical of the U.S. role in the world and quite critical of the way the United States is structured. How do you celebrate the 4th of July?
Not. I don't. The 4th of July, I think, is one of those holidays that I, from my point of view, simply can't be redeemed. It has become so identified with a national glorification, what I would call a kind of national fundamentalism, an absolute belief in the certainty of U.S. superiority and benevolence, that I can find no way to engage the holiday in a productive fashion. I think what the 4th of July should raise for us now is two things. One is a more honest account of our own history. Certainly the United States history includes a lot of inspiring events, a lot of inspiring characters, and a lot of inspiring philosophy that has come out of it. At the same time, there is a dark side to U.S. history, and that's often ignored. And here I think we have to, really hold the conservatives to their own rhetoric again. One of the things that you'll hear the Bill Bennetts and Lynn Cheneys of the world, conservative cultural critics, they'll say, the problem with the United States is kids don't know their history. And that's a problem. And on this, I agree with them. We don't know our history. The problem is we don't know our history in all of its full depth. And when you try to bring that into the public debate, you say to them, yes, let's talk about history. Let's talk about the genocide of indigenous people, which created the United States. Let's talk about the reality of the contribution of African slavery to the economic growth of the United States. Let's talk about the debts then owed to people because of these crimes. Then what are you told by the right wing? You're told, why are you wallowing in the past? Why are you stuck in the past? I get this all the time when I want to bring up history. So on the one hand, we're supposed to revere history as long as it's celebratory, and we're supposed to insist on more history. But the minute that history starts to take into account the complexity of our experience, then we're told we're wallowing in the past. And I think that shows you the hypocrisy of those kinds of critics like Bill Bennett and Lynn Cheney. So the 4th of July can be a platform for that discussion. And I think it can also be a place to examine patriotism, not just how do we define it in the moment, but whether patriotism, that is, a love of or loyalty of a nation state, is really compatible with our deepest moral principles. Why should our loyalty be to the nation state? I think that's a fundamental question that we're going to have to ask in the coming years as the nation state system that we live with produces so many, not only, you know, crimes, which have been with us throughout the history of the nation state, but now at a level where we can really imagine the end of the planet when we talk about global war, we talk about the kinds of weapons available to nation states, and we talk about the ecological destruction that's going forward under this system. So I think the 4th of July is a place to talk, not celebrate.
You know, you've just raised global war, environmental problems, the deep problems that threaten the survival of our species on this planet that face us in the next century or so, if not sooner. How well equipped is our political system, in your view, to address these issues? How successful are the existing political parties and politicians addressing these issues? How much can we trust the system to work satisfactorily? I mean, or how concerned are you with the state of politics as it's run in the United States, electoral politics today?
Well, I think it's simply not equipped for the task you define. And in fact, I think the whole society at some level is starting to recognize that. One of the things that's interesting, I get to travel a lot. I'm very lucky. I get around the country a fair bit and get to talk to people. And one of the things that I've noticed is that people are afraid. Now, you know, in some ways, this has, you know, been a hallmark of the last 5 years, the fear of terrorism post 9/11. We've seen the way that politicians manipulate that fear. But I'm not talking about that kind of fear. I'm talking about a much deeper fear that I sense in especially progressive people, that we are up against forces that are not easily reversed. I'm talking here about the ecological collapse, the political breakdown, the sort of trajectory of modern capitalism. You know, people recognize that we aren't going to fix all of this just by electing a better president or getting control of Congress back in the hands of the Democrats. I mean, people recognize that we are in a time of really fundamental change and that those political institutions are not adequate. I mean, when even the opposition party, you know, gets up and says the way we're going to, you know, try and win your vote is to promise you more of everything, at a time when it's quite clear that the United States cannot continue to try to acquire more of everything, that one of the fundamental problems we face is that the standard of living of the first world, especially the United States, is simply unsustainable. Can you imagine, Bob, a politician standing up today and saying, I want your vote because I'm going to help reduce your lifestyle. I'm going to help take us down to a sustainable level of consumption. Well, I mean, you might as well commit political suicide on the spot. So we can see that the way it works now, no politician is going to be a driving force for the kind of change we need. That doesn't mean I'm depressed about the possibilities of political change. It means just like in most of history, at points like this, the real creative ideas and the energy to pursue them is going to come not from the professional political class, not from the universities. It's going to come from ordinary people who are struggling at a level of honesty. And I see this across many issues. Just before you called, I got off the phone with a friend from a Catholic parish in California who's talking about rejecting the institutional church and starting almost from the time of the early Christian model again of small cells of people fashioning a new kind of theology. Well, you know, there's people all over this country talking about that level of political change. And that's where I think the hope is.
Yeah, that hope's been there for a long time. Do you have a vision at all? And I'm asking a difficult question because I don't think I could necessarily answer. In fact, I know I couldn't. How that kernel translates into something that does tangibly change power relations?
I think at this point it's almost the wrong question, which is a way of course, evading a question I can't answer because I don't know either. But I think that we do take a risk, I think, if we try to crystallize that force before it understands itself and understands what we're up against. You know, it's true that there are certain patterns in history. It's true that, for instance, social movements that capture the energy of ordinary people have been that motive force of political change. But that doesn't mean it's going to play out today the way it played out in the civil rights movement or the abolitionist movement or any of the other successes in history. I think we're at a period in which we have to admit we don't know much and be open to new ways of doing things. That's why, for instance, to go back to a point you raised earlier, anti-war demonstrations. I know they're important. I know they have a role. But it seems to me that given the control over the propaganda system that the people in power have, that putting even 500,000 people in the streets of New York tomorrow is not going to have the same effect it had during the Vietnam War demonstrations, for instance. The contours of the landscape have changed. So I'm not saying we should never do mass demonstrations, but I'm saying it's quite clear that they are not going to advance the movement the same way they might have done 30 years ago. And we have to recognize that. And then what's so hard about that is we have to say, well, we don't know what takes the place of the mass public demonstration in strategy terms.
Go ahead, Bob.
But it's important, I think, to admit our ignorance in that sense.
I'm Bob McChesney. You're listening to WILL AM 580. This is Media Matters. Our guest today is Bob Jensen, professor of journalism from the University of Texas at Austin, joining us for a broad discussion of politics and media. This is a pre-recorded show taped shortly before going on air. So for the remaining 7 or 8 minutes of the show, please just sit back, relax, and let us do the talking. Bob, one of the real developments in media in the past 5 or 6 years that's really exploded, particularly in the last 2 or 3 years, has been the rise of the internet, in particular what's called the blogosphere. And some people argue that this has really overwhelmed traditional media, which are soon to be on their way to the dustbin of history. What is your sense of the blogosphere as one who probably participates in it, and how it affects traditional media and what its hopes and promises are for our political culture?
Well, Bob, I always like it when you ask me questions on which you have more knowledge and insight than I do, but I'll play along.
I'm grading you, and then I'm going to send you your score after the show.
You know, I have two different reactions. One is a personal reaction. As someone who is trained as a professional journalist, and even though I'm critical of mainstream media, I do have a great respect for the craft of journalism. And in that sense, the blogs kind of irritate me because they're largely unedited. They're largely written very quickly. They're often very speculative in nature, and I'm old school. I think writing is a craft that takes time, and it takes editing. It takes both self-criticism and criticism from others. So I find myself feeling, I don't know, maybe like parents listening to Elvis in the 50s, you know, like, well, that's not really music, or that's not really journalism. But of course, that's a personal reaction. I don't have a blog, and I don't do that because it doesn't fit the way I try to write. Certainly, though, blogs have had one positive effect we can see right now, which is they've helped us hold contemporary journalism more accountable. That is, mainstream journalists know there is now this force out there that can fact-check them. Now, that's good and bad. It's good when we find errors in contemporary journalism and force their correction. But it also creates this sort of almost instant firestorm that can erupt even when a news report is correct. We saw that with the Dan Rather scandal around the Bush National Guard documents. The story that CBS News ran was fundamentally true about the way in which Bush evaded his obligations in the Guard during the Vietnam period. The problem was, of course, it was this one apparently forged document, and the blogosphere got a hold of it, this case the conservative blogosphere, and drove it into the ground and forced, you know, CBS to, in a sense, have to abandon the truth of the story because of the controversy around it. Now, I can't say I have any particular hard feelings about watching Dan Rather leave. I've been critical of Dan Rather for an entirely different set of reasons about his subordination to power. But certainly that had a negative effect, I think, on the conduct of journalism. So I think, you know, I think I would probably take the easy way out and say it's a little too early to tell. But I think we can see positive and negative forces to it. I think we can also see that the mainstream media have to adapt, but they're not going away. Remember that most of the major internet portals are connected to existing corporate commercial news media, you know, CNN.com, you know, MSNBC. Mm-hmm. So it's not as if the internet is simply a space for alternative. It's also a space that the corporate sector is colonizing. And as you're well aware, you know, the current controversy over whether net neutrality is going to go by the wayside is partly about who's going to control that space.
Are there any particular blogs or websites that you check out on a regular basis?
Well, you know, not surprisingly, the blogs that I do tend to look at are the blogs my friends do. But that's because I know them. I trust their analysis. So my friend Rahul Mahajan has a very good space where once a week he launches a commentary, empirenotes.com. Another friend of mine has one at underthesamesun.com, or excuse me, .org. You know, what I tend to do is follow the lead of people I trust. And that's a reminder that whatever the Internet does, and it does many things very well, it's a great way to share information broadly. The real guts of politics, it seems to me, always has been and always will be personal connections at a level that builds community. You know, one of the things that makes people willing to take risks, and that's really what brings political change, is when people are willing to take risks. What creates the conditions under which one will take a risk for a political principle? Well, it's usually not because you know things or because you have a website that you can go to. It's because in your own life, you have allies, you have friends, you have comrades who you know are on the same path as you and who you know will back you up. That's what I think gives people the courage to act politically. So we have to remember that while the Internet can bring us together, it can share information, can do all sorts of things, it cannot create that kind of what I would call political community. At least I don't think it can. Others will argue with this. But I think in the end, it's on the ground and face-to-face, which goes back to our earlier conversation. It's partly why I joined a church, because a church is not an Internet site. It is it's a building. It's a space. It's a place where people come together on a regular basis and make commitments to each other.
Bob Jensen, we've spoken almost entirely about the United States in the first 50 minutes of today's program. In our last couple minutes, let's broaden our view, and on a matter of hope or sort of coming to terms with the situation of our species on the planet right now, as you look outside the United States, do you see hopeful signs for the future?
Well, sure. Everybody has been talking about the political trends in Latin America, for instance, the way in which left and populist governments are taking power, the support for those. I'll let others analyze that. Let me just tell you a quick story about a friend of mine, a journalist in India. I know you're familiar with his work, P. Sainath.
Yeah, he's been a guest on the show.
Sainath is a tremendous... He is one of the great journalists in the world today in that tradition of a critical, independent journalism. Sainath writes for a particular paper in India, one of the largest English-language papers. He also freelances and has achieved a kind of fame in India that makes his writing a real brand name, if you'll excuse the term. Well, Sainath, for the last 2 years especially intensely, has been covering the agricultural crisis in India. Now, if you pick up the New York Times, you don't read about the agricultural crisis in India. You don't read about the collapse of the rural economy. You don't read about farmer suicides increasing because of the collapse of purchasing power of the farmers. What you read about is Bangalore and outsourcing and Internet technology. But there's an underside to India's success, and that is the huge inequities which are, in fact, growing. Sainath has been covering those. He's been out in the villages. He's been out in the fields. He's relentless in his pursuit as a reporter, not just as a pontificator, but as a reporter of what's happening. Well, I just talked to him the other day, and the Prime Minister's office of India has contacted him and wants a meeting between him and the Prime Minister so he can explain just how deep this crisis has now gone. In other words, the reporting of one guy at one newspaper in India has led to increased government attention. Now, of course, governments love to form commissions and ignore problems, but because I think people know Sainath is there day in and day out, and he's not going to let up on this, and the media is starting to pick up on it in the regional press in the states of India. Well, to me, that's hopeful. India, you know, when I was talking about India, is the world's largest democracy. In many ways, it's far more democratic than the United States. It still has a very vibrant press. It has a political discourse that's much wider and deeper than in the United States. There are functioning left parties, actually, that run states in India.
Bob Jensen, unfortunately, I think at this point, I'm going to have to pull the plug on our show. I hear the band tuning up for the Tavis Smiley Show, which follows us here. Thank you so much for being our guest today on Media Matters.
Always great to be with you. Thanks, Bob.
And listeners, I'll be back in 167 hours for another show of Media Matters. Thank you very much. Goodbye.